From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The Obama record, his re-election campaign, and the middle class. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After a first term full of disappointment, some progressive Democrats are saying the president finally found his voice this week in Kansas. In a carefully crafted speech, he picked up on the rhetoric of the Occupy movement denouncing Wall Street and supporting the 99%. But does his record match his rhetoric? Will centrists see him as the champion of the middle class or an advocate of more government regulation? And how does his re-election agenda stack up against that crowded field of Republicans? We'll get a range of opinions from across the political spectrum. On Reporter's Notebook later on, Amazon's latest assault on traditional retail. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Progressive Democrats are applauding the campaign themes laid out by President Obama this week in Kansas. Liberals are asking, where's the beef? Has he put Republicans on the defensive? How will he sound to the centrists who decide elections? On Reporter's Notebook, Amazon will be offering discounts to shoppers who use its new barcode app to check prices at brick-and-mortar stores and then buy from Amazon. Will big chains or local mom-and-pops be hit hardest? First, this news update. The European Union summit of 27 countries has come up with a plan to save the euro unanimously, except for Great Britain, which doesn't use the euro anyway. France and Germany call it a breakthrough. Poland and some other countries say they're not so sure. Stephen Erlanger is in Brussels for the New York Times. Stephen, always good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren.
So far, markets around the country seem to have reacted to this positively. What was the problem with Great Britain?
Well, it wasn't just Britain, but I mean, Britain wanted what it wanted, which was protection from future dangers as David Cameron perceived it. Now, Cameron is a self-acknowledged Eurosceptic, and he decided for internal political reasons to try to use the opening of a treaty change to get some powers back from Brussels. And he was rebuffed with that. So then he wanted, in return for agreeing to a treaty change, special protections for Britain, and Germany and France in particular said no. So they decided to go around Britain, and they did so through a non-treaty, non-EU treaty, an intergovernmental agreement. But that agreement has attracted the support of at least 24 to 25, possibly in the end 26 of the 27 nations. So Britain seems very isolated. And a lot of it is simply due to Cameron, I think, misjudging the moment.
Here's the way it sounded in the words of David Cameron himself.
It's not easy when you're in a room with many other people who all want to press ahead, who all say, forget about your safeguards, forget about your interests, let's all just sign up to this thing together. It's sometimes the right thing to say, I'm afraid I cannot do that. It's not in our national interest. I don't want to put that in front of my parliament because I don't think I could recommend it with a clear conscience. And so I'm going to say no, and I'm going to exercise the veto. That is effectively what I did.
Stephen Erlanger, back to you with the New York Times. So what does this mean for the future? And is it still likely that Europe will split, that the euro itself might not survive?
Well, there are two issues. I mean, one, you know, it in a way, Britain opted out of the euro 20 years ago, and what happened here is a strengthening of the eurozone and the economic rules and even a kind of growing federalism about the euro. So having opted out of it 20 years ago, it's not in a way surprising Britain would not want to be pulled deeper into that project now. I think it hurts Britain's voice in the world. Part of it's personal. Cameron has annoyed Merkel and Sarkozy and some others. I don't think it's the death knell for Britain's participation. It's just that right now you have a very Eurosceptical mood in Europe led by the Tory party, and Cameron is caught between Europe and a very upset domestic party. That's one thing. The second thing is the short-term problem of the euro itself and the crisis over debt and worries about Italy and Spain. And they did go some way here to create a larger firewall to protect Italy and Spain. More money will be going through the IMF. There are other technical things that they're doing. I'm not sure it's enough. There's a lot of debt coming due for refinancing early in the year. And I think markets, you know, like to see momentum. But this is not the big firewall that will necessarily save the euro. What they agreed to were procedures that might prevent another crisis down the road, but don't necessarily fix this one.
So you say there might be enough money, but maybe not. Hasn't the problem always been that the countries are independent economically rather than all responsible to the same central bank? That, I take it, hasn't been changed.
No, and in fact, you know, Germany is still quite determined not to let the European Central Bank be the lender of last resort for the euro. What the problem is of these countries who have the best credit ratings are worried if they put up tons more money into a bailout fund, their own credit ratings will be hurt because their own budgets will be stressed. So they're looking for ways to leverage the money they have. They're looking for ways for their individual central banks to put money through the IMF, which won't be right on national budget ledgers. And they're hoping for some more investment from the outside. I mean, they're trying to build this firewall, but a few bricks at a time. It can't all be done at once. And the markets, as you know, are very flighty.
They're okay at the moment, but we don't know how they're going to be next week, much less 2 months from now. Stephen Erlanger, as always, thanks a lot for being on our program. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Warren.
Reporting from Brussels for the New York Times. In a moment, Teddy Roosevelt, the middle class, and Barack Obama on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and only back, but to the point, President Obama chose the town of Osawatomie in the red state of Kansas this week for his first major effort to lay out the themes of next year's re-election campaign. He invoked Republican President Theodore Roosevelt, who made a speech in the same town more than 100 years ago, calling equal opportunity the cornerstone of democracy.
This is the defining issue of our time. This is a make or break moment for the middle class and for all those who are fighting to get into the middle class. Because what's at stake is whether this will be a country where working people can earn enough to raise a family, build a modest savings, own a home, secure their retirement.
But the president said, rungs on the ladder of opportunity have grown further and further apart, and the middle class has shrunk while inequality has been growing.
Inequality also distorts our democracy. It gives an outsized voice to the few who can afford high-priced lobbyists and unlimited campaign contributions. And it runs the risk of selling out our democracy to the highest bidder. It leaves everyone else rightly suspicious that the system in Washington is rigged against them, that our elected representatives aren't looking out for the interests of most Americans.
Once again, President Obama earlier this week in Kansas. Richard Stevenson is political editor at the New York Times. And Richard, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Glad to be here, Warren.
Set the stage for us. How is this different from his campaign in 2008 so far? And how are circumstances different, in addition to the fact, of course, that he's now in the White House?
Well, you know, clearly he was able to run in 2008 at a time when, you know, even many Republicans were unhappy with the Bush administration, where, you know, there was really a palpable desire for change, a real change of direction in the country. And where he was able to, you know, quite brilliantly in political terms, let, you know, all kinds of different constituencies see in him what they wanted to see. It's really hard to sustain that in government, and obviously circumstances for the country and for the administration politically have been very difficult since he got to the White House. So I think, you know, he faces both the reality of running as an incumbent with a record, with a difficult economy, with a re-energized Republican Party and conservative base that's determined to get him out of office. So it really is a completely different equation for him now.
Is it a little risky for him to say, as we just heard him say, that people think the system in Washington is rigged against them? He obviously is part of the system in Washington.
Yeah, I think, you know, the balance there is probably between making a nod to the quite intense populist sentiment that's coursing around out there in the country, both on the left and the right. It was interesting that at one point during that speech, the president alluded to the kind of signature line emanating from the Occupy Wall Street movement, which was the 1%, 99% line. And I think that, you know, they clearly wanted to signal both to kind of, you know, classic liberals as well as to, you know, the more populist sentiment out there in the country that he gets it, and that he wanted to, you know, reassure all of them that he hears them. But I think he was doing another thing, too, with that speech, which was to try to make this election about bigger things rather than smaller things, the big things being, you know, the nature of our government, the role of government in society, the direction of our country, rather than, as the, you know, Republican presidential candidates are all trying to do, make this a referendum on, you know, his performance in running the economy in particular and the current state of the economy. And so that speech really tried to, you know, kind of elevate the stakes, if you will, for voters.
Richard Stevenson is political editor, once again, at the New York Times. Michael Tomosky is editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas. That's a progressive journal. He's also a special correspondent for Newsweek and thedailybeast.com. Michael Tomosky, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks. My pleasure, Warren.
You were one who said that you thought that the president finally found his voice in this speech. What do you mean?
First of all, I mean that he's given a series of bad and uninspiring speeches over the course of the last several months, maybe the last couple of years. And he's obviously been floundering politically. If you look back over the year, everybody remembers the debt ceiling fiasco. It was a fiasco for the White House from the summer. People forget that back in the spring, there was the government shutdown threat, which was another situation in which the White House essentially let itself be taken hostage by the Republican House of Representatives and gave in on some big spending cuts and lost the political battle in all of those, in both of those situations and in others throughout the year. Obama hasn't looked like much of a leader and hasn't really tapped into anything to connect to the people. I think that with this speech, I noticed a difference in the quality of it. Just listening, you know, you could tell in 2 minutes. You know, in the way that you can tell sometimes if you're flipping around the channels, Warren, and you happen across a movie, you can tell in 2 minutes a lot of times whether the movie has any energy or not. You could tell that about this speech. This speech had energy. It had some conviction. He was making a connection between his own beliefs and the current political mood, a mood that he didn't create, a mood that was created largely by Occupy Wall Street protesters, but one that he has that he found a way to tap into, and I think he managed to present a vision of that's a very stark alternative to the Republican vision, but it did so in a very non-threatening way.
Again, Michael Tomosky, editor of Democracy, a journal of ideas. The president, of course, slammed the Republicans.
After all that's happened, after the worst economic crisis, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, they want to return to the same practices that got us into this mess. In fact, they want to go back to the same policies that stacked the deck against middle-class Americans for way too many years. And their philosophy is simple. We are better off when everybody's left to fend for themselves and play by their own rules.
Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional lawyer. He's an author and contributor to Salon.com now. It's good to have you back on our show.
Thanks for having me back, Warren.
What did you think of this speech? You're somebody who's been very skeptical about the president. You didn't like his first term at all. You thought that he had in many ways betrayed the liberal wing of the party of which you are a member. Now it sounds like he's swinging back the other way. Do you find it credible?
I think the problem that the president is going to have is that everybody knows that he gives very good speeches when he's motivated by his own political interests to deliver them. Everyone heard lots of extremely innovating and inspiring speeches in 2007 and 2008, and the reason that worked was because he didn't have a long record to judge him by. You had to basically judge him by the things he was saying and promising to do. 2011 is extremely different, and 2012 it will be as well, than 2007 and 8, because he's now been in office for 3 years. And I think voters and people in his own party and independents are going to be judging him far, far more on his record in office, what he's done in office, rather than the pretty speeches that he's capable of giving. I think there's a lot of Democratic partisans who are looking to be excited and will latch onto these speeches kind of as a sort of deja vu or reminiscing of all the things that they liked in 2007. But I think most people are going to want to ask whether his rhetoric matches up with his actions. And this newfound love for talking about income inequality, the middle class, and people who are striving to get into the middle class, I think doesn't match his actions in office. It certainly doesn't match his results. And I think that's going to be a problem that isn't going to be surmountable by giving a bunch of well-delivered speeches.
So, Michael Domosky, are you doing wishful thinking, do you think, when you say that maybe he's going back in the direction you want to see him going?
No, I don't think I'm doing wishful thinking. I mean, it's the obvious place for him to go. It's the only place for him to go. If the political mood is is one that is open to some populism, I wouldn't go so far as to say a populist moment, a quasi-populist moment. But if that is the political mood, and I think it is, that's the sensible place for him to be. Now, the extent to whether it translates into marvelously populist and proletarian accomplishments in a second term, well, who knows? You know, I mean, that's not only up to him. You know, that's up to who controls the Congress too. in terms of announcing priorities and saying what he's for. That's the least he can do. He can try to do that and present a different alternative and see where people go. But no, it's not wishful at all. I think his priorities are pretty clear. Whether the effectiveness of in the way in which he's fought for them is another question.
Glenn Greenwald, isn't it true, as Michael Tomosky indicated earlier, that for the last year he has not had the House of Representatives on his side? Hasn't his record been thwarted by the Republicans?
To some extent, it's a little strange to bracket out the last year. Recall that for the first 2 years of his presidency, 2009 and 10, his party controlled both houses of Congress with extremely large majorities. In fact, having close to a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, if not a filibuster-proof majority. And so it's very strange for a president who's been in office 3 full years, 4 as of the election, whose party has controlled the Senate the entire time and the House of Representatives for all of that time except for 1 year, to run against Washington and the way Washington is failing the middle class as though he's some sort of insurgent or outsider rather than the person who's in charge of the party that's been running things and the person who's wielded the most power. It is true that Republicans to some degree have thwarted some of his agenda in ways that are shameful and irrational. But it's also true that a lot of this is on him. I mean, if you look, for example, at the HAMP program, which the Congress allocated lots and lots of money to, billions of dollars to help homeowners modify their mortgages, it's been a complete failure because the White House just didn't prioritize it. They were instead interested in the people who put them into power in 2008, which was Wall Street interests, and that's who essentially has been in charge of economic policy. And so, sure, you can blame the Republicans to some degree, but it's going to be a difficult task, I think, to convince Americans, given who's been in power, that it's the fault overwhelmingly or even primarily of the Republican Party.
So let me go back, Richard Stephen, to Richard Stephenson, the political editor of the New York Times. We're hearing a lot of skepticism, even among Democrats. The president's approval rating now is 44%. I believe that's less than what George W. Bush had at the end of his term. He really has an uphill battle.
Well, one of the interesting things this week was the juxtaposition of the speech in Kansas against the decision that his administration announced against allowing non-prescription sale of the Plan B contraceptive, which was another example of a decision that the administration's made that has left a lot of progressives feeling, you know, uncertain about, you know, the level of his commitment to their causes. The previous one along those lines that got the most attention, obviously, was the EPA decision a few weeks back. So, you know, Obama's always had a certain degree of ideological elusiveness, you know, that may or may not serve him well going into the general election, but it certainly, I think, has contributed to the skepticism about him in the Democratic base.
What about that, Michael Tomosky? And in addition, the issues of maintaining the war in Afghanistan, mechanisms for government intrusion into people's lives that were so criticized by Democrats during the Bush administration.
There are a lot of grounds on which to criticize. There's no question about that. you know, I think this Plan B decision is, I think it was a very shocking decision to the advocates in that world. I think there was
And just quickly, that's the morning after pill, and
yeah.
It is now not available on a non-prescription basis to young women under 16, which the FDA had recommended, but the Health and Human Services Secretary overruled that. Go ahead.
Yeah, she overruled that, and you know, you'd have to think that there was some White House involvement in that decision, even though that's the official line is that wasn't the case. But look, at the same time, you know, the enthusiasm gap is actually narrowing. Republican voters are becoming less enthusiastic. I just saw a poll to this effect yesterday. Republican voters are becoming less enthusiastic about their choices, and I should say rightfully so. They don't inspire a whole lot of enthusiasm. Democrats are starting to tick up and get a little bit more enthusiastic as the race comes into a little bit more shape.
Okay, we're going to talk with some Republicans in just a moment. Final word from Richard Stephenson in our last few seconds, the political editor of the New York Times. There's talk now of possibly the Republicans having a brokered convention and somebody other than those that we have been seeing so much of lately being nominated.
Well, you know, that kind of talk tends to crop up in most election cycles around this stage. It's probably a little bit early. You know, I do think that there is, you know, concern both, you know, at the grassroots level among conservatives as well as among you know, whatever passes for the Republican establishment these days, that their candidates are imperfect, to say the least, and they're generating, you know, some qualms about whether there could maybe be somebody else out there.
Thanks for being with us. We'll be right back with To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Well, we're only back with To the Point, talking tonight about President Obama's speech this week in Osawatomie, Kansas, where he presented himself as the champion of a beleaguered and shrinking middle class.
This isn't about class warfare. This is about the nation's welfare. It's about making choices that benefit not just the people who've done fantastically well over the last few decades, but that benefits the middle class and those fighting to get into the middle class and the economy as a whole.
John Ferry is a Republican strategist. He is CEO of the Fahiri Group. Good to have you on our program.
Hey, Warren. How you doing?
Well, thank you. Is this about is this really about class warfare?
Well, you can't talk about how you want to redistribute wealth and go after spread a little wealth around and go after rich people and say they've got to pay more when they already pay so much and not think it's about class warfare. Of course, it's about class warfare. But I do think that President Obama is being very smart about talking about the middle class, because ultimately it's the middle class that he has to attract if he's going to win the next time around. And I think for him, he's got to kind of gear in his messaging with the white working class and middle class voters, who he's largely lost and is polling miserably with right now. And so I think he was smart to give this speech. I think it was well messaged. But I think his biggest problem is, at the end of the day, it's not going to work because his policies haven't worked.
What are the challenges, though, for Republican candidates when he makes a speech like this, which does appear to touch on so many of the current issues in politics, including the populism on both the left and the right?
Well, I think that the Republicans have to understand, and some are starting to get this, that you have to message yourself and come up with policies that attract middle-class and working-class voters. I mean, you have to, get off the kind of strict ideological debates and talk about policies that actually work. I mean, talk about college tuition. Talk about the fact that wages have stagnated. Talk about how the marketplace can help create more jobs, and get on the message of talking directly to working class and middle class voters. And I think that the fact of the matter is that Republicans historically are doing better than they ever have with especially white working class voters, and they have to make sure now that their policies actually attract them and continue to attract them, because if they do that, they'll do pretty well in the next election.
Rather than talking policy, though, don't they have to appeal to the various ideological groups within the Republican Party? They're still in the primary. Nobody's been nominated yet.
Well, you can do both. I think that the fact of the matter is that a lot of the folks in the Tea Party, a lot of folks who are most frustrated with government are those working class voters. If you look at there has been kind of an interesting shift where the Republicans used to be the party of the rich, and that's just not true anymore. If you look at who's voting for the Republicans, and so you can do both. You can kind of gear your message to different ideological groups, and more importantly, you have to make sure that you're hitting the wide swath of the American people that are sick and tired of a government that's just not working well for them.
John Fehere, a Republican strategist with the Fehere Group. Mark McKinnon is vice chair now of Hill & Knowlton Strategies. He worked as President Bush's media strategist, but he left the McCain campaign because he was so impressed by Barack Obama. I don't think, Mark McKinnon, you voted for Barack Obama, but you come from an interesting place as a Republican. Welcome, first of all, to our program.
Hey, thanks a lot, Warren.
What do you think about this speech?
Well, first of all, let me say that I stepped out of the general election because I liked what Barack Obama's campaign represented. But I have to say that, like a lot of other people, I've been disappointed. And this speech was a terrific speech rhetorically. But my real issues with the president so far have been that there's been a lot of great rhetoric all along, and the problem is that there just hasn't been a lot of bold ideas behind it. And when you're president of the United States, you're in the big chair, and you're there to make big, hard, tough decisions, not political decisions, if you want to provide real leadership. So it really has concerned me that when he had the opportunity, that he created his own fiscal commissions, two of them, not just one, but two, and then completely walked away from them. He had a super committee that couldn't come together, and so...
Well, that wasn't his super committee.
It wasn't, but the reason the super committee had to come together was because he hadn't been able to do it on his own, and he had to defer, something to Congress because he wasn't able at the executive level to come through because he walked away from his own commissions a year before that. So, I think, like John said, I think it's politically it's pretty smart, and what I've heard recently that's been very striking to me, and I saw it in some focus groups just this last week, is that the nature of the dialogue now has really shifted from what a year or two ago was a lot of discussion among Americans about big government. Increasingly, we are hearing voters talk about income inequality and the stress on the middle class. So there's no question that President Obama's political team are tacking into what's happening with the American public. So the question is, they're figuring out what the problem is. They're figuring out where American voters are. The question will be, can they provide big ideas and real solutions to what is really creating problems for the American people?
Mark McKinnon with Hill & Knowlton. John Fehere, back to you. Do you agree with some of the Democrats that we've heard from that in many ways President Obama sounds an awful lot and has behaved an awful lot like President George W. Bush?
You know, if you look at the Democratic base and all the polls, they're going with Obama again. You know, some on the far ideological left might disagree with some of his policies, but some of his policies have been necessary to protect the nation. I mean, especially on the security thing, he's been pretty good because he's followed in the footsteps of George Bush, and that's fine. But that's not going to anger the left because, you know, the left, like the right, they want to, most people want to, you know, stay safe. So I think that the president mostly has governed from the far left, and as Marcus said, you know, he's been largely ineffective. And I think that's his big problem. He has not come up with – he doesn't need big ideas. He needs any ideas. I mean, you know, the one thing that got Bill Clinton reelected was a series of small ideas. And, you know, Clinton has a lot of small ideas and got them through. Obama has neither small or big ideas and just kind of uses these big lofty words and lots of rhetoric and to no real effect.
Let me go back to Glenn Greenwald, our liberal Democrat. Do you agree that the president has, in fact, governed from the far left?
I mean, it's probably the most ludicrous claim that exists in politics. I mean, not only is this a president who, you know, as he just said, has followed in Bush's footsteps with what was 3 years ago the most controversial policies of the Bush administration among not just liberals but Democrats, which were war and foreign policy and terrorism approaches that he's replicated. Even domestically, if you look at what's supposedly his most leftist achievement, which is the healthcare reform, people on the right and the left both will tell you that healthcare plan was originally pioneered and designed by the Heritage Foundation, one of the most right-wing think tank groups in the United States. It was something that Mitt Romney embraced almost to the letter. And, you know, it was something that was drawn up and drafted with the lobbyists from the pharmaceutical industry and the healthcare industry in the White House. This is how he has governed. There's been no redistributive policies. There's been nothing that anyone on the left would recognize as leftist, let alone far leftist. That's just standard rhetoric that Republicans spell whenever there's a Democrat in office.
John Fahiri, standard Republican rhetoric?
No, it's actually, you know, the problem is the stuff on the left doesn't work very well. And the as implemented, the health care law is a far left-wing thing. It's not all that they wish for, but it's all they could get because the country just doesn't want to go that far. And frankly, the country doesn't like the health care law. You know, the president has tried to govern from the left. That's why there was a big revolt against him, that the first stimulus package he had was a grab bag of all the ideas that Nancy Pelosi and David Obie could come up with. So he has tried, and he's largely failed, and that's why he's been a very ineffective president.
Mark McKinnon, you're a moderate Republican. Do you think the health care law is, in fact, a leftist creation?
Well, I'm not happy with the outcome because I think that it got into legislative morass and the president deferred too much of it to the Congress. And there are things that I'd like to have seen with free market and pooling across state lines that would have addressed the cost of health care. And that's where I think the real issue, and ironically, it's a lot of these entitlement programs that are shifting costs to and entitlement payments to seniors that are actually creating the income inequality. So it's programs of the Great Society and democratic ideas that are actually responsible for a lot of the inequality. One of the things that struck me about the speech that was kind of odd if you step back is that it sounds like a great challenger speech. You know, this sounds like a guy who's running against an incumbent, and yet it's his administration that he's responsible for, but you wouldn't know it from the speech.
Let me go back to our first Democratic guest, Michael Tomasky, with Newsweek, The Daily Beast, and Democracy, a journal of ideas. What about that? And is that an effort by the president to not have the campaign be a referendum on him?
Sure, it is. And, you know, the conventional wisdom is that that can't possibly work, that a re-election campaign is by definition going to be a referendum on the incumbent. But there is a sense in this case in which that might not necessarily be the case if the Obama re-election effort is very adept at doing it. And the reason for that, Warren, is that the Republicans in Congress have been so unusually obstructionist, particularly since they took over the House of Representatives, and particularly on these questions relating to fiscal policy and economics, that Obama might be able to sell the argument to a majority of voters and to a majority of independents that, look, our economic problems are as much the Republicans' fault, even more the Republicans' fault, than mine, because I've been trying to do these things. I tried to do this payroll tax. reduction. Apparently, that's probably going to pass in some form. But you know, the Republicans have been standing in the way of that for the last couple of weeks. In other words, you know, not without going through the whole list, he can say, "I've tried to do A, B, C, and D. I tried to impose this tax, surtax, on people who make more than $1 million a year, which 70%+ of people support in polls. I've tried to do these things. The Republicans have blocked them every step of the way." I think that, depending on the circumstances, he can make that sale. And so then it's less of a referendum on him.
Mark McKinnon, back to you. You were part of the George W. Bush re-election campaign in 2004. Do you see similarities here for President Obama, not on the issues, obviously, but in other ways to the campaign that you were involved in?
Oh, I see a ton of similarities, and I'm already hearing some of the themes that we talked about in message during 2004, particularly the notion that we wanted to make that election, and they want to make this election, a choice and not a referendum. We didn't want that 2004 election to be a referendum on President Bush. We wanted it to be a choice between John Kerry and George Bush. And you already, even though there's no nominee yet, you're already hearing from David Axelrod and David Plouffe and other of the president's advisors that it's important to think about this election as being a choice and not a referendum. But it's also similar because the President Bush in 2004, going into that election, we looked at it, and his favorable ratings were well under 50%. They was support for his policies were well under 50%, and even well under 50% didn't personally like the president. So that's a pretty tough place to start, and you know you're going to go into a tough election with those kind of numbers. But in many ways, we were blessed by the nominee of the Democratic Party, and that certainly could be the case for Republicans. And the reality is that depending how they frame the election, it will be a choice, and so in large measure, the success of the Republicans to articulate a message and create a winning candidacy will be on the quality of the candidate.
John Fiore, back to you, our Republican strategist with the Fiore Group. What about the choices that Republicans have now? They don't seem to have come even close to a consensus. There seems to be a new leader every couple of months. What are the prospects that your party might, in fact, nominate somebody who can't hold up to President Obama?
Well, that should be I hope it's a bigger concern among our primary voters. It seems like it hasn't been. Look, we have to nominate someone who can have credibility and can appeal to not only the Republican base, but also to independent voters, swing voters, which obviously are the most important part of any election. And, you know, right now we've gone through kind of a rotation. It seems like it's been amazing to see these people who some of these primary voters seem to like. And although I you know, you get that sometimes. Remember, Pat Robertson won the Iowa caucuses several years ago. So you get some of this process that looks kind of odd. And at the end of the day, I think we will nominate someone. My guess will be Mitt Romney, who will be credible, and that will be you know, the referendum. He will be the candidate that provides that credibility that you need. And at the end of the day, it will be a referendum on President Obama. I think the problem for President Obama versus George Bush is the unemployment rate is much higher for President Obama. And, you know, President Bush was able to have a Republican Congress that largely did a lot of things that he wanted to do, so he was able to set up what he wanted to get set up. President Obama has had, you know, a whale of a time in the last year and a half getting anything through, and that's going to be problematic for him.
Mark McKinnon, nobody has voted yet. Not a single vote has been cast, and yet every scenario you can imagine has been proposed. What about the prospect of a brokered convention? Is it possible that Mitt Romney can't put it away, that nobody else can either, and that the party goes into the convention without a real a choice? Is that even conceivable at this point?
Well, it's, you know, it's every member of the press's dream that will happen. I think it's looking increasingly like it's going to be an extended, drawn-out nomination contest. And I think there's some, you know, we've seen some spectacular things happen in recent weeks, and I think some more spectacular things are likely to happen. But all of them lead toward the conclusion that it's not going to happen cleanly or quickly. So, yes, I think that's a possibility, but the other thing that's more than a possibility, that's an absolute reality, is that there will be a third party or third parties plural that will have a big impact on the outcome as well.
You're certain of that?
I'm absolutely certain of it.
Well, who's going to be the candidate?
Well, don't know yet. But I do know that there is an organization like Americans Elect out there that has already gotten signatures for half the ballots to be on all 50 states, and they'll nominate somebody in March. But they're going to be on the ballot in all 50 states.
Are they going to nominate somebody who's conservative or somebody who's...
We don't know that yet, but it's going to be a unity ticket, so it'll be a balance of both a Republican and a Democrat, because by the bylaws, it has to be a member of both parties.
Michael Tomasky, back to you, our Democrat, moderate Democrat. What about that? We haven't heard much talk about Americans Elect, and yet, as Mark McKinnon said, they've gone a long way to getting on a lot of ballots.
If they exist, the Republican will win. Even Newt Gingrich, who's completely unelectable, will win if they exist, because all they're going to do, something like Americans Elect, is split the non-conservative vote. The conservative vote is about 40%. The non-conservative vote is about 60%, and all they're going to do, so they're going to accomplish nothing except electing the conservative. I'm not so sure that that there's going to be a major centrist third-party push, because when you really get down to it, there's not that much that is really different between this ideal Americans Elect candidate and Barack Obama.
Glenn Greenwald, again, our liberal Democrat, do you think there's going to be a third party, and would it have the impact of defeating President Obama?
I agree with what Michael just said. If you look at what these dreamers of a third-party fusion ticket are constantly insisting upon, this sort of centrist approach, it really does replicate almost exactly what President Obama is already doing. I mean, one of their main demands, for example, is that there be significant entitlement cuts as a means of debt reduction. And, of course, in the last round of negotiations, President Obama sought significant cuts to Social Security, a reduction in the age of Medicare eligibility. So it just seems extremely redundant, although I do agree that if there were a third party, it would certainly hurt the Democrats more, since the true believers in the Republican Party are going to vote Republican. I just don't see any real motivation behind it, other than a small sliver of this pundit class, because most of what they want to see happen is already taking place within the top levels of the Democratic Party.
John Fiore, we're out of time, but very quickly, your reaction to the third party?
Well, now I'm rooting for a third party. you know, I think that the most effective third parties usually come from the right wing or the left wing. If you look at, you know, George Wallace or Henry Wallace.
Not from the center, you're saying?
Not usually from the center, historically speaking.
Okay.
So because people in the center usually want to get, you know, they're usually too risk averse and they want to be with the winner.
Okay. Thank you all very much for being on our program. John Fiore, Republican strategist, Mark McKinnon, formerly with the Bush campaign, Glenn Greenwald, liberal Democrat, Michael Tomasky, more in the center, as a progressive, and our earlier guest, Richard Stevenson, political editor of the New York Times. Thanks, all of you, very much for being on our program today. Amazon has a new smartphone strategy for competitive pricing. Traditional stores are outraged. Is all fair in love, war, and retail? Back in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To the Point.
Warren Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Starting tomorrow, Amazon is offering discounts to shoppers who use its smartphone app to scan barcodes in brick-and-mortar stores and then buy the products from Amazon. Chris Moran is senior editor at Consumerist.com. That's a blog owned by the publishers of Consumer Reports. And Chris Moran, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Glad to be here.
Tell us how this works.
It's pretty simple. You download the app. Turn it on. You scan a barcode, and Amazon identifies the product, it's a bit iffy. It still needs a bit work. It'll show you the price on Amazon, not just the price that Amazon sells, but also if there are third party vendors who sell through Amazon, it shows their prices as well. In addition to that, if you turn on the location identifying thing, where it shows, it lets Amazon tells Amazon where you are, then you have the option of putting in the price that's on there, because the barcodes don't actually include prices in most cases. So you actually have to manually enter the price or take a photo of a price tag, and that's where you get the discount. When you send that in, Amazon rewards you for giving that information with a small discount.
Why is it worth it to Amazon to offer you a discount for that service?
Oh, because they want to know what stores are charging, especially as they they get into, they have an expanding grocery selection, not, you know, fresh food, but I know I get my toilet paper through Amazon every 2 months because it's about 30% cheaper than even going to Costco for me for the same stuff. And it just gets delivered to my door, and it's great.
You sound like a careful shopper.
Yeah, I am. I mean,
that's
my job, isn't it?
Right. Let me introduce Susharita Mulpuru, who is from Forrester Research. That's a technical technology research company based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Is this fair?
Well, the challenge is that, it's great for consumers because they just get to get an additional discount on anything they're purchasing. The question is, do you just end up making a store a showroom for Amazon.com? And that's been fundamentally the frustration of every bricks and mortar company with Amazon these days.
Well, isn't that what Amazon is in business to do, compete with everybody else?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, at some level, yes, that's true. But I think that what they're getting into is a question of predatory pricing. Because Amazon, there have been a few studies, actually, from various investment banks and research companies that have said that Amazon is consistently lower in pricing across all product categories that it sells. And, in fact, it actually loses a lot of money. In many cases, they're selling things below cost. And they're making it up, and they're able to stay profitable because they have other profit pools, everything from ads on their site and, they have digital goods. They have other revenue streams that help to subsidize this. But it really, you know, is the same argument that years ago existed about Walmart.
Predatory pricing sounds evil, but is there anything illegal about it?
The question is that, how it benefits communities, and do you end up driving other businesses out of existence, especially in a way that may not be above board. And, you know, and I think that it's a fine line because, you know, I mean, people ultimately vote with their wallets, and consumers will often take lower prices over, you know, kind of the ability to patronize local stores because that's what they prefer. But at the same time, you know, if you're a small business person, it's very, very difficult to compete against Amazon. And then that begs the question of, well, do we ultimately end up having just fewer stores altogether? Because that's not a good outcome for our economy either.
Let me go back to Chris Moran with theconsumerist.com. Would this hurt the local stores, the community stores the most, or would it hurt the chains that are already driving the local community stores out of business in the first place?
I see it hurting the chains more than local stores. I think most people who patronize local stores go there for service. They go there knowing that they are paying a higher price. I think most people go to Best Buy and Walmart thinking they're getting a low price on a TV or a laptop or whatever you're buying there. And you are for a retail store. You're getting a lower price than you would at most small stores. But I think as soon as somebody whips out their smartphone, and they were doing this before there was ever an app, you could easily just go on Amazon on your smartphone and just put, you know, look up the item, just type it in. And our readers have been referring to Best Buy as Amazon's showroom for years. And they're hurting, electronics retailers especially. They're looking at shrinking their retail square footage by 25-30% over the next couple of years because people just aren't coming to the stores anymore. They're going online to buy. Yeah, I think it's hurting them. I think those stores are looking more toward their own online presence as the future of those stores.
So, Susharita Mulpuru, is this one predator going after another or a bunch of others?
Yeah. Well, it's in a lot of ways, yes. There's no question. I definitely agree that the big box stores, this is probably one of the biggest. This is a threat even to the biggest of the big box stores. There's no question about that. I think that the feedback and what they'll respond with is saying that retail is one of the largest employers in our economy. There are millions and millions of people who actually work at physical retail locations. And if you do have these smaller footprint stores and there are fewer people buying in these stores, that you have fewer people employed, and, that continues to hurt the economy in other ways. So that's likely the pushback that we'll hear. One could argue the merits of that because a lot of these retail jobs are not necessarily the most lucrative or not necessarily the highest quality. quality jobs that exist. But that's still the argument. And yeah, absolutely. There is no question that, you know, is it one predator going after another? I mean, it's that's the irony of this whole situation, is it's companies like Walmart and Target that are crying foul when in fact they've been, you know, kind of the companies that have benefited from the retail environment for the last 20 years.
Chris Moran, just a few seconds left, but what about this? Is it inevitable, do you think, that there'll be more retail online and consequently fewer jobs?
Oh, yeah, I think that's definitely the way it goes, because I just think especially in economic times that don't look to be improving in the immediate future, it's hard to ask a shopper to spend $150 more on a TV at a retail location than he would online, just because it'll save some people their jobs, because that could mean, you know, if that person ends out of a job, then that's $150 more in their pocket that they have in case they do lose, you know, their income.
Okay, same thing works for television as for toilet paper. I want to thank you both for being on our program. Chris Moran with Consumerist.com, Susharita Mulpuru with Forrester Research.
Thank you.
Producers of To the Point are Anna Scott, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Sonia Geis, and Caitlin Schamberg. Our technical director is Mike Newport, managing producer Karen Radziner. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. Join us on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point.
PRI, Public Radio International.